Picture this. You have a long commute to work and just want to listen to a good podcast, but there are too many choices. Anime, film, comic books, science. What will you do?
Well, never fear. We are here with all of your podcast needs.
Welcome, all freaks and geeks. We are the Square Roundtable Podcast, a collective of Black nerds discussing all things anime, comics, science, and pop culture related. Please join us for our weekly podcast every Friday on squareroundtablepod.fandomlim.com, YouTube, and wherever else you get your podcasts. Be there and be square.
Hello, everyone. Screenplay Archaeology host Kira Midhead here. Before we get into today's episode, I just want to get some intro stuff out of the way. First things first, we are now part of the Fandom Lim Media Podcast Network, so I'm going to link their site down below. And that's why you would have just heard a promo for another podcast, because they're another one of the shows on the network. And as per usual, if you like the show and you'd like to know more, you can check out our social media pages on Facebook, Tumblr, Twitter, and even Instagram now. The show also has a Patreon if you're willing to gift money, but you don't really need to if you don't want to. And we also have a Discord server, which you can join if you want to chat with, you know, the group members there. So that link is going to be down below as well. So yeah, sit back, guys, and enjoy the show. All right, everyone. Hello and welcome to the Screenplay Archaeology Podcast. I'm your host, Kira Midhead. And tonight we're doing a new episode for the month of November. Hopefully I can have this up. I won't be able to put it up on Thanksgiving, but since it's November, I'm going to try and get this up by the end of the month, probably sometime this week. And it fits as a Thanksgiving episode because I'm going to be looking at the 13th Warrior, specifically a draft that will give you a potential look into what John McTiernan's original cut of that film would have been like before Michael Crichton and the studio interference got in the way, reshot some stuff, changed some things. And this is not going to be like a solid look at that, but it's not the final version because there's some differences here and there, and they may not have shot everything that was here. But this is probably the closest we're going to get for quite some time as to what that would have been. And the reason I say this kind of fits for Thanksgiving is because the original title was Eaters of the Dead, like the book. And eating, feasting, Thanksgiving, it fits, right? Vikings went to America one time. And so before I get into it, and I'll leave the background, I'm going to keep that pretty brief for this just because I don't feel like getting too much into it. And I feel like we can go on into too much detail about that kind of stuff sometimes here. But I'm just going to give a quick synopsis just so people, especially you, Corporal Hicks, if you're listening, because you were the one who first complained about this. If you don't know the plot, the story essentially is that it's about a courtier from the Caliph's court in Baghdad in 922 AD, or CE as they say now, who is banished essentially for his relationship with someone else's wife. And he gets it's a banishment in air quotes, because he gets made to an ambassador to this people in the far north. And on his way there, he runs into a community of Vikings who have come down the Volga River, or come up the Volga River, depending on which way you're looking at it. And he gets roped into their quest to go north to Scandinavia and fight a lurking threat that comes with the mist. And basically what it does is that it takes this guy who was an actual real historical figure and heavily fictionalizes things and has him go along into a more realistic what-if-it-really-happened version of Beowulf. And I've always thought that was really cool. Now, the book was Eaters of the Dead from 1976, which was only Michael Crichton's, like, fourth novel under his real name. He had written several under a pseudonym before Andromeda Strain, which was technically his debut. And it's very different from his usual stuff. He doesn't usually write period pieces. And he usually writes stuff with like a technological angle to it. And this and The Great Train Robbery he did back to back, and he eventually directed the film version of The Great Train Robbery, which I finally saw not too long ago, and it was actually pretty good. It's a pretty interesting book. He basically mimics the style of like an actual medieval document, complete with introductions, you know, stuff at the end, footnotes and all that. And it's actually quite fun. And I love the fact that apparently it's so convincing. People have actually called up libraries that are mentioned in like the end notes and to try and track down sources that don't actually exist. And later on, he added an afterword to later editions of the book where he mentioned that like, oh, he did such a good job of faking his own sources that he couldn't tell which ones were real and which ones were fake. And it's really funny because the last thing in the bibliography at the end is the Necronomicon, edited by H.P. Lovecraft, it says, which is just hilarious if you know about that. But no, it's a good little book. It's an interesting little story. The whole concept of let's make Beowulf more interesting, or at least prove that it can be an interesting story, because that's sort of the genesis of it. His friend mentioned that he thought Beowulf was one of the great boring stories they teach in literary courses, and Crichton's like, actually, I don't think that. And he basically wrote Eaters of the Dead to be sort of a retort to that stance. And he pretty well succeeds. It's actually a very compelling little read. It's a very short book. I actually have the first edition, which I found on eBay, and it doesn't make me a super fan because this thing was pretty fucking cheap as far as first editions go. It was like $20. And it's in good condition, and it's a nice little hardcover. I like having it because I really like the book. But I came to it from the movie, which came much later. Now, it was initially announced that they were doing an Eaters of the Dead movie in the early 90s, probably because, you know, Jurassic Park, that book's rights had been sold, and like, I believe the rights were sold off before the book was actually released in 1990, so there were probably studios going, ooh, this could be a big thing. And in the early 90s, it was announced that Stuart Gordon was supposed to direct it, which is really interesting. Now, the title Eaters of the Dead, I can see that being a Stuart Gordon movie. I don't know how that would look, him trying to direct this story, if he would try and make it kind of goofy or whatnot. But that's an interesting thing to think about. And I do have a script from around that period, so I'm assuming it's the version he would have directed. And it's called Eaters of the Dead, and it doesn't have a writer listed on it. It just says, based on the novel by Michael Crichton. And it's been assumed in a couple of circles I kind of run in that it was a Michael Crichton draft. And I'm starting to think that is the case, because I have a couple of early versions of Conga, which were from the early 80s, and they're both formatted like that on the title page, and at least one of them is definitely written by Michael Crichton, because he was writing and directing the movie at that point before he gave up on it, and then lazed around at the studio for years and eventually got made in 1995, which is not a great movie, but it's a fun movie to watch, I'll say that much. And it was, you know, that big 90s glut of Crichton adaptations where it felt like they were grabbing all of his books and doing movies of them, except for Airframe, which is kind of funny. You know, there's a script for Airframe out there, but I've never read Airframe. My understanding is that it's not a particularly cinematic subject matter. But, you know, in the 90s, you got Rising Sun, which I haven't heard great things about. The Jurassic Parks, of course, although Lost World is barely an adaptation of that book. Which always confuses me for reasons I'll get into if I ever do a Lost World episode. Disclosure, I've seen bits of. I haven't heard great things about it. Sphere kind of sucks. Congo is a fun, kind of dumb movie. And 13th Warrior, which I really like. It's a movie that has like a real spotty reputation, at least critically, because it did horribly with critics when it came out. Bombed to the point that it's one of the biggest bombs of all time, largely because it was, I guess, the budget got inflated by the reshoots, and it came, I read somewhere that barely got a release, like it was like a limited release, and it came out around the same time as The Sixth Sense and got absolutely steamrolled. But, you know, it's directed by John McTiernan, who's a very solid director. Well, most of it's directed by John McTiernan. There's reshoot footage that was directed by Michael Crichton. And basically what happens is that they shot the movie, the studio didn't like what they saw, and so they went back, reshot bits of it, added some stuff, cut some stuff out in post. Those reshoots were directed by Michael Crichton himself, who was actually rather proud of the final product. And I give him, even though, you know, I don't condone his approach to treating McTiernan the way he did, I do kind of appreciate the fact that he's one of the people who can kind of see the movie for what it is, or could. He's passed away since. And it just has been, always been this kind of, you know, lost movie idea of, you know, the McTiernan cut, to call it that. I think I'm probably one of the only people who's ever actually said release the McTiernan cut unironically as like a spoof of the whole Snyder cut thing. And really, I think this would be more, I liked the Snyder cut of Justice League okay, but it's one of those things where it's like, okay, Zach, your ego took over a little bit and some of the stuff you did there. It would be interesting to see McTiernan come back and make a recut of this to make it more like his original version. So there's a few things that got changed here and there that I'll talk most about the stuff that impacts the story as we go along. But a couple of things that I kind of wanted to address now is namely the title. I don't know why the title changed. I guess because they wanted it to sound like less of a horror movie, because it really isn't a horror movie. I don't even think McTiernan's cut would have been that much heavier on the horror. But there was that teaser where it was still called Eaters of the Dead, which is very intense, very creepy. Doesn't really represent the footage you see in the movie. But it's still a really great teaser, especially compared to the fucking trailers for the 13th Warrior. Dear God, no wonder people stayed away from it. Just for anyone who hasn't seen it, look it up on, just type in 13th Warrior trailer. First of all, type in Eaters of the Dead teaser, then look up the 13th Warrior teaser. The 13th Warrior teaser has the music from the fake Robert Downey Jr. trailer in Tropic Thunder with the gay monks. It plays the exact same music. It's so funny. And it's edited in such a goofy way where you could easily put in like a needle drop in a couple places. It's so stupid. And it has like the epic voice guy going, once, blah, 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 he made a mistake, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, oh my God, why did people think that was necessary in trailers? Do they think the audience is stupid that they need like a voiceover guy to explain what they're watching? It's not even right. He makes a couple of mistakes of what the movie is about. But yeah. And so this script, I will say the 1991 draft, I may cover that down the road, but it's a different thing. I'll say right now, it's basically just the book, very condensed, which is another reason why I think it's a Michael Crichton draft, because I've read a few of his adaptations of his own work. Like I've read one of the early versions of Congo was basically just the book condensed, as is his Jurassic Park draft. It's basically the book, very, very condensed, whereas what you got in the final movie was quite a bit different. So yeah, and I think that'll be something that might be worth covering with a different approach down the line. But I wanted to do this one because A, I'm doing it by myself. And B, I think this one has more of an interest behind it because the people who know about the 13th Warrior would be more interested in this. So to get right into it after 11 minutes of farting around, the script is called, it's titled Eaters of the Dead, and someone has somehow managed to stick in the 13th Warrior over Eaters of the Dead, and it's credited to John McTiernan and William Wisher. And what's interesting about that is that there's another credited writer on the movie, Warren Lewis, who is not on this. I don't know why, because he apparently was the first writer to work with McTiernan on this. I listened to a podcast where he guested on it and talked about the experience, and he came up with a lot of different scenes in this along with McTiernan, which are in this draft. I don't know why he's not mentioned on the title page. That's very strange. Unless it's been like whited out or covered up or something, because I've seen that happen on a couple drafts where like the date was there, but it was like covered or whited out or something. And then I eventually saw the actual title page elsewhere with the date on covered, the actual date on it. That's happened. But I don't know what's going on here. But, you know, credit to Warren Lewis. Look, I think it's called like Perfect Screenwriting or something, or The Perfect Screenwriter. Just type in Warren Lewis 13th Warrior on YouTube and you'll find it immediately. There's some interesting stories he talks about, you know, his interactions with John McTiernan there. And so this is where we go. So it starts with, so yeah, it's an undated draft as well. So I don't know where exactly this falls between shooting and writing and all that. But it opens with, now the movie, I think it's almost kind of infamous how the movie starts in like this very kind of abrupt way, where it starts with the main character, Hamad ibn Fadlan, on the Viking ship, and then flashes back to the beginning, and you get this quick sort of summation of, you know, the incidents in Baghdad before he leaves, and you get like a map that's like hilariously wrong, and then we cut to him running from the Tartars with the caravan. This does something similar, and according to Warren Lewis, he said that he initially wrote out this whole sequence, the much more detailed sequence in Baghdad, and it was McTiernan's idea to cut it back. Now, I think a little bit more than is on the page here was filmed, because there's shots of Antonio Banderas in the Baghdad scenes in the trailer that are not in the movie, and they're not represented here. So it's like, what is going on there? There's a scene of him looking over to his left or to his right, which is not in the movie. It's very strange. So I don't know quite what to make of that. So it is a single page where he goes like, he had an affair with a man's wife and he got sent to the ambassador to the far north as a result. And the narration is like, it's not in like regular dialogue blocks. It's in like big bold letters. But yeah, it's done in like a single page, which is very interesting because it doesn't really set up who he was before he left. the way the movie does. The movie does that a little bit better. And then it just, after the first, so yeah, it's a little strange. He also mentions the calendar, like how in the Muslim calendar, it was, you know, he left and he mentions that he met the woman in the month of Ramadan in the year of the Prophet 336, or as the Christians would have it, the year 922, which never comes up. That doesn't come up in the movie. I don't think they ever mentioned the date in the movie from what I remember. And he doesn't explain who he is. Like in the voiceover in the movie, I think it's a little bit better because he mentions about how he was a poet in the court and life was easy, blah, 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 which I think is a little bit, I think that's just a little bit better setup than what we get here. So I am praising the final cut a little bit. Also, he says here and in the movie that he became the ambassador to a people called the Tusuk Vlad. And I don't know where that comes from, because in the book and in the old script from the 1991, he was the ambassador to the Bulgars. And the Bulgars get mentioned in the movie as a list of these peoples he traveled by. But it doesn't really, but I'm like, I don't know where the name Tusuk Vlad came from, because every time I've tried to find something on it, it just comes up with the quote from the movie on IMDb. So there's that. And so it then goes to the caravan getting chased by the Tartars to, because the Tartars attack, as in the movie, to the Volga River, who back off when the Northmen's ship appears on the water. And the caravan follows the river and runs into the Northmen's camp along the shore so they can't get away. This is interesting because I didn't pick up on that was what was happening in the movie until I read this again. Because in the movie, it's just like they're on the shore and then like, oh, you get a shot of the camp. I think that's due to the editing, because that just wasn't clear to me from watching it the first time. And also, so we get Ibn Fadlan and his servant Melchizedek, who is Omar Sharif in the movie, who is probably, in terms of the cast, he's probably the movie's biggest critic, or was. But he was, like, I mean, he actually quit acting for, like, 4 or 5 years because of the movie. I'm like, damn, man, you've been in worse movies than this. Chill. And what's interesting about this is that, so we get more of an introduction here to the camp, where we get to see the caravan leader, who is played by Eric Avari, who is in like a bajillion movies. If you've seen him, you know who he is. And he's very obviously dubbed over in the final cut of the movie, because I'm like, that is not his voice. And he's barely in it outside that one scene. And so here we get a little bit more of him. The caravan leader speaks to a blonde giant we later find out is Holga, one of the 13. And he speaks to him outside the camp, and the guy just picks him up and carries him off into the tent. And Melchizedek is like, we've been invited to dinner. There's a lot of great dialogue in this opening. Like, this whole opening has been really cut down to the bone in the movie, from what I've noticed. There's a lot of dialogue, a lot of really good exchanges here. And, like, character building between, because Ibn Fadlan in the movie, he just kind of narrates, Melchizedek, an old friend of my father. And they just kind of leave it at that. And poor Omar Sharif is just stuck being the guy who's there to deliver exposition, basically. And here you get more of a sense of their relationship that, yeah, it is master-servant, but they've also known each other a long time. They're very friendly with each other. He was Ibn Fadlan's, he's referred to as the gentleman's gentleman, but he was also his tutor when he was a boy. That comes up. And so then they kind of like have like a kind of like combative kind of back and forth where they give each other shit, which is very interesting. It's a much more interesting dynamic than what ended up on film. I don't know how much of this was shot, but I kind of wish some of it was, if it was maintained in the film, because it's really good stuff. And it would have given, you know, a little bit more for Omar Sharif to chew on, and maybe he could have been prouder of the role. And we get this kind of scene that was cut out of the film, because we see Ibn Fadlan leaving his tent and like his nice clothing, but there's a scene here that's not in the movie where he's getting ready, like fussing over how he dresses. And while they're at dinner, and so we get, so like I said, there's more dialogue than in the movie. He comments more on how he dislikes, you know, the Northmen's ways, which I could see why they cut some of this, because it does get a little bit repetitive. And there's also a spirited discussion about whether Melchizedek should taste the food before Ibn Fadlan does. He's like, I'm not trained as a food tester, which is pretty funny. And they're still talking to Herger de Joyous, who's one of my favorite characters in the movie, played by Dennis, if I'm mispronouncing this, Storhoy, who is just awesome. And I wish he got to do more bigger stuff than he did, because I've not really seen him in anything else, because I'm not up on all the Scandinavian movies. But he's so great in 13th Warrior. It's like, how did no one see this and go, put him in more stuff? But no, he gets a little bit more dialogue as well. And so we get the scene where they go before, it's the big dinner scene that goes on quite a while. And we get the scene where Ibn Fadlan gets introduced to Bulvi, the Beowulf equivalent. And they mention that there's the other contender, because they mention that, their king is dead and he's the heir apparent, but there's this other guy who's also a possible heir. And in the movie, what happens is that while he's reciting for him, and he chooses to pick, like, it's Genesis, but I'm guessing maybe it's a Quranic version or a Muslim version. And he starts, but he gets interrupted when the guy tries to kill Bullvine, Bullvine kills him. That doesn't happen here. It mentions that, eventually, soon enough, one is going to kill the other. But instead what happens is that Holga, the big dumb guy, sneaks up behind him, picks him up, tosses him to a bunch of giggling women who it's noted in the script, they're speculating about Arab dick sizes, which was pretty funny. And that comes from an instance in the book where they're like, they're speculating that, you know, women here, they think, you know, Arab men must have much bigger penises. And he's like, oh yeah, my women think much the same of you, which is pretty funny about how that's like a popular myth that people think about men from far away. So yeah, so you can tell they read the book and really thought about it. And so the king's Viking funeral scene follows, which is the main historical part of the story, because in his Ibn Fadlan's actual account of going north to the Bulgars, he did witness this Viking funeral, and it's one of the only descriptions we have of it. And so that's one of the things they kept from the real story. You know, with setting, with, you know, getting the ship, putting him on the ship, setting it on fire and pushing it off. You know, the classic Viking funeral, I think the description that we know comes from the real guy's work. And so we get the funeral scene here, and then they have the servant woman that they bring, and they're like lifting her up onto the boat, and she says, you know, the Viking prayer that becomes a running motif in the movie and comes back at the end in a really awesome way. And in this in the movie, they just kind of watch it passively. And here, when they realize that the woman is going to essentially be a human sacrifice, they're like, oh shit, and kind of just stop talking. Like, even Melchizedek just loses interest in translating for a second. He's so put off by this. I think that's a great emotional reaction. I don't know if they shot it, but it would have been cool. And so the next morning, a ship arrives in the mist with a boy standing on the bow. And this has always bugged me in the movie that they talk about, it's because of the mist, he's being polite. And I'm like, there's no mist in this scene at all, guys. Fog machine break? What happened? It's so Ibn Fadlan wakes up, Melchizedek is gone. So this is missing from the movie. He goes to the longhouse, which is like a building made out of like turf here instead of a tent. But he goes there, finds them. He's like, oh man, if you kick them hard enough, they'll get up and make you breakfast. So I wish that was in the movie. But here the conversation about, you know, what the boy is doing, because, you know, they think there's spirits in the mist and they aren't sure if he's real. That's here, but it's intercut with this thing about the washing bowl getting passed among the Vikings, where they're like spitting in it, blowing their noses in it, and then washing their faces, which is based on something from the actual account as well. So it's intercut amongst the action. And there's a line which is really great, because in the movie he just pushes it away and then nothing happens. In this, he pushes it away and Herger says something and Melchizedek translates it as what? Do Arabs not believe in cleanliness? Which would have gotten a big laugh. And so the boy, who's Prince Wulfgar, he enters the longhouse soon after, and, you know, and the dialogue is not as expository here. Expository, that's the right word, right? Sorry, my vocabulary sometimes fails me. And it's not explained in as much detail, and the idea you get here is that Melchizedek doesn't really understand much of what's being talked about. So you don't get the fact that he's the son of Hrothgar yet, but you do get the idea that his father's kingdom is being threatened by something which should not be named. And they talk about the power of words together, and there's a really interesting moment here where he says, you know, words can't summon things into being. And then Melchizedek says, don't you remember what I taught you? Allah summoned the world into being with words. I thought that was really cool. And there's a few references here and there to his Islamic religion here, to the fact that he's a Muslim, which aren't in the movie. And I'm wondering if that's like a compromise, because apparently when the movie was being made at Touchstone, like, the Disney executives were like trepidatious about the main character being an Arab, and they tried to like remove all references to Islam. And it was like the only thing McTiernan and Michael Crichton agreed on was that needed to stay. And I wonder if some of these more explicit references were compromised out of the movie because of, you know, the reshoots. Maybe Crichton like had to give a little or something. I don't know. But it's interesting to think about. And so the Oracle Woman, the Angel of Death, is brought in, and she, you know, we get the whole scene where she goes, she's cast the bones and she says 13 warriors are needed to fight the evil, and the men volunteer. And it's not a big scene on the page like it is in the movie, where it's like a big like bombastic montage of people stepping up. And that's something that's interesting, because I don't think that would have been on the page at all. I think that's just really great direction from McTiernan and that really insanely good Jerry Goldsmith score, which that's the one thing about the McTiernan cut where I think almost there's a couple things which I'll talk about some of them later, But like the one big thing where it's like, I don't know if the McTiernan version would be better in this sense, because originally it was scored by Graeme Revell. And his score is on YouTube. You can listen to the whole thing. It's actually really good. Like, it's pretty great in places. But Goldsmith's score, he came in, had to make this thing really quickly, did a kick-ass job on it. And it's one of those things where it's like, do I want to see the movie without that? That's a big moment where I'm like, I don't know. I can't say for sure. But no, this whole scene happens, and then she says, oh, the 13th warrior needs to be someone who's not a Northman, and Aben Fodlan is the obvious choice. And that's a scene in a trailer where it cuts to him going, oh, the 13th warrior is you, and it pauses, and I'm like, the way it's edited, it's like, where's the needle scratch? I'm waiting for it. And so we get a scene that follows that isn't in the movie, but it's in the trailer, and I'll describe it, and I'll talk about why this should be in the movie. It's in the bad trailer, not the good teaser. And so we get a new scene that follows that night of Aben Fodlan pleading with Melchizedek about how he can't go because he isn't a warrior. And then he responds with, well, that much is obvious. That bit, him saying, I'm not a warrior, and then that response, that's in the trailer. So this was shot. This scene was shot. And he doesn't want to go. Like, he's reluctant, and he even toys with the idea of sending Melchizedek along because, you know, at least you can communicate. But then he's like, oh, it's, you're like 60 years old. This will never work. So it's like a moment of weakness, but he realizes this is never going to be a thing. And then the caravan leader shows up and says the caravan is making a break for it to swamps to the east, saying the camels can outpace the horses there. And he even offers to hide Aben Fodlan with them. But the young man decides he can't run from his responsibilities anymore. And as Melchizedek says, he's having a rare attack of adulthood. And so the caravan leader curses him for a fool, saying he'll die and no one will tend his body. And that does make him stop and think for a bit, but he still goes. This is important. This is important to his character. This should have been there, because in the movie, they go, oh, you're the 13th warrior. And it's just kind of like, yeah, okay, I guess. And he goes along with them. This is a good dramatic moment, which just adds so much to him, adds so much complexity to him, adds more to the relationship between these two characters that you don't get enough of. Yeah, it should be here. And also, more screen time for Eric Avari and his weird dubbed-over voice. And so the next morning, you know, we get introductions to all of the warriors besides the Aben Fodlan and Beowulf, and I almost called them Beowulf Bullseye, whom we've already gotten our introductions to. So I'm going to read these out, because there's a few characters in here who aren't really given much time in the movie because of the cuts. And so it says, and we meet the men. Ragnar, the dour, hand axe always in motion as if it had a bloodlust of its own. Mounted and anxious to leave, to him festivities are burdens endured to get at enemy limbs. Higlek, the quarrelsome, veteran of hundreds of battles, one of which took his arm. In its place, his elbow sprouts a halberd, a battle axe with a curved blade. It's interesting to watch him eat. I don't think we actually see him eat in this script at any point. Skeld, the superstitious, clothes and saddle festooned with talismans. His weapon of choice is a mace, a steel ball on an oak shaft which he wields with shocking precision. Weath, the musician, fought in Ireland and brought away instruments, among them a chanter, a proto-bagpipe, alternately bracing or haunting, in camp or in battle. Roneth, the horseman, carries flails of heavy chain, similar but more deadly than a medieval mace and chain. From horseback, they'll go through an enemy like a salt. Halfdane, the fat, he's the cook, has the caretaking manner of a 300-pound Jewish mother. That does not come across in the movie at all. Edtho, the silent, he's the scout, lightly armed, built like an acrobat. Weapons are stealth and invisibility, vanishes for days, but returns with information, and blood on his daggers. He can speak, but rarely does. Rethel, the archer, can pluck a hawk from the sky, a horseman from the saddle, or an enemy from behind a stone wall. Beside him, always, except in the movie where he's been very carefully edited out most scenes, is Haltoff the boar, the archer's apprentice, no relation but devoted to him, already a deft maker of shafts and bows and a skilled long-distance killer. Together, they're deadly snipers 1,000 years before anyone knew the word. There's Holga the wise, the blonde giant we've already met. He's called the wise because he has twice the strength of an ox and half the brain. And our friend Hergur the Joyous likes women almost as much as fighting. A guy you'd want watching your back in a bar fight, but he'd want it to be a crowded bar. He's surrounded by admiring women. He kisses two or three. So yes, these are the characters. And we get little introductions to them that granted wouldn't, should, they're kind of unfilmables. But throughout the script, you get moments with each of them, so you at least know who they are, most of which have just been cut from the movie in editing. And there's some places where you can see the little character moments, and they, if you've read the script, you can see where the character moments are supposed to be, and they've been cut down to the bone in the editing. And it's really unfortunate, because that's really one of the only criticisms I have of the film, aside from, I think the big final fight is a little lackluster. It's not bad. It serves pretty well for what it does in the movie, but it's just the weird way it's shot with all the weird slow motion and stuff isn't that great. And some of the reshoot stuff I'll talk about when we get there, but it's that and the fact that there's a few of them who just kind of fade into the background, especially Holga, who I really tried to pay attention to in my latest viewing, because I watched it again after reading this, and I think he's the guy who's in the background in a few scenes. And he looks like one of the brothers from Slapshot, kind of. He has that kind of goofy look about him. I think that's meant to be him. And I don't even think you see him die. You see Higlak, or at least they may have swapped some of the names around. But Higlak, you see him get his head ripped off in the first fight. But Holga's like, oh yeah, he's dead too, by the way. And Higlak, there's mention of the fact that he has... You don't really see the fact that he's missing an arm in the movie. You just get the line where it's like, oh, your head has gone searching for your hand. I'm like, oh, I guess he's missing a hand. So yeah, I kind of wish this. And the big one is Haltoff the Boy. He's still credited in the movie, but he's very trimmed out of it. And I've read that maybe it was because with the lengthy production and the fact that they reshot the finale, he looked too old. So they just tried to, cut him out of the movie completely almost. But you can still see, if you know, look for him, you can still see him in certain places throughout the film. And it's like, oh yeah, he is in the movie after all. And he's even the most blatant time you see him is he's at the end waving goodbye on a horse. And I never thought about it before, but I'm like, after I found out about that character, I'm looking at it. I'm like, yeah, there's a kid waving goodbye. Who the hell is that? And once you know he's there, it's easy to pick out his scenes because he's almost always in the background, off to the side, or facing away from the camera, or obscured in some. It's very strange that they chose to do that. Because, even George Lucas, when he re-edited the Young Indiana Jones episodes in the movies, he didn't care that Corey Carrier was different ages and scenes. He just slapped them together like that. So, yeah, 0.1 George Lucas, 0 points to Touchstone and Michael Crichton. And so we get the joke here about how, only an Arab would bring a dog to war, talking about how much smaller his horse is. Even though, historically speaking, I just have to point this out, it doesn't really bother me when I watch the movie. There's one thing that does, and I'll talk about it because it's really stupid when I get to it. But historically, at this point, Vikings had small ponies, and an Arab like Ibn Fadlan would have had a really big dog. Dog? He would have had a really big horse. He would have a much bigger horse. And the whole bringing a dog to war thing is kind of funny and hypocritical because in multiple scenes throughout the movie, Bolvi has a dog with him, even during battle scenes. So it's your own leader is bringing a dog to war. Maybe don't make a joke about that. He has this big-ass wolfhound he takes in the battle with him. It's like, what? And so Ibn Fadlan and Melchizedek, they have a longer, more heartfelt goodbye, where you get the sense that these two have known each other a long time and are, in fact, good friends, despite the amount of shit they give each other. And you find out that Melchizedek, he's taking over as the new ambassador because, the Tussock of Allah, they won't know the difference anyways, which is pretty funny. And the Northmen have offered to escort him there. And so he also says, he says, I'll try and meet you, when this is done, I'll try and meet you again. But if the worst happens, he promises to write Ibn Fadlan's father about it. That's such a good moment. Why is that not in the movie? And then we learn from Herger that the swamps are full of fever. And it's a nice little interesting twist of fate that Ibn Fadlan, by going on the seemingly more dangerous route, avoided a nasty death. I like that quite a bit, too. And so the journey by horseback across country, if I'm remembering the book right, they follow the river in a ship for a little while longer, and then eventually they get off it and they ride across country. But they just go straight to the horses in both the script and the movie. And it goes much the same as in the movie, where they're just traveling across country, and we get the montage of Ibn Fadlan learning their language by listening, which is so fucking cool. But here, the montage here is more explained, and it's always in a different location when it fades back in, which isn't immediately apparent from watching the movie. And I don't know, once again, I don't know if this is something that they shot or not, but I still think it's... I think it works the way it's portrayed in the movie. Fades happen, so that means time has passed and they're all sitting in different locations. Sometimes it's raining. And I just think that's one of the most brilliant little scenes in the movie, and I'm going to have to go up to where it's described, because it's written in a really cool way. And in the And in the podcast I listened to, Warren Lewis talks about he came up with that with John McTiernan. They're out on his ranch in Wyoming somewhere and outside in the cold, and they sort of hashed the idea out together. So that's pretty cool. And so it's in a parenthetical. It says, note, you know how in a Bergman movie, which is in Swedish, the people sound like they're speaking English? Rhythm and tone are right, just the words are right. Even then, every 10th word is the same as the English, and that holds true in the movie as well, because when they're all volunteering, you can tell exactly what Bolvi is saying, because he says, ja, I be the first. If I'm pronouncing that wrong, sorry, Scandinavians in the audience. In what follows, Eben, because he's just called Eben, so that joke is actually kind of baked into the script, where they don't understand his name, so just call him Eben. Eben, so the script does that too, which is pretty funny on a meta level. Eben listens to the Northmen, who will presumably be speaking Swedish, and the percentage of English words gradually increases. And it's such a cool way they do it. And it's one of those things where it's like, McTiernan did something similar in Hunt for Red October, which is also a great fucking movie, where it's like they're speaking in Russian, and it zooms in on the mouth and zooms back out, and they're speaking in English. Very cool idea. I like the fact that they even address the language barrier, I think, is, you know, kind of daring for back then. I mean, they do eventually all speak English in the movie, but the fact that they even did that is kind of, you know, in the 90s, you know, I don't think they gave the audience enough credit for that sort of thing a lot of the time. Heck, even now people bitch about subtitles, so, you know, it is what it is. But no, that's a very cool way to describe it, because it is true. You listen to certain, you know, Nordic languages, and you're like, yeah, it does kind of sound like English a little bit. But, you know, they're in one camp, in a deep forest, then they're on treeless plain, then they're in a swamp, then they're by a river, and then, so this is them as they go. He's slowly learning the language. Now, that's not exactly how it works in real life, but I think it works cinematically. And eventually, days later after the other one, you know, this is where we get the scene where he, you know, knows their language, because I listened, and he lays down like the sickest fucking burn, calling him a pig-eating son of a whore. And then you get the scene that follows where, because, you know, I like that scene because it in the movie and in the script, because it shows, you know, it's the first time they really think anything of him, that he kind of impresses them with his intelligence, which I like that. I like how, you know, the bond builds between the characters. That's one of the best things about the movie, is especially the friendship that forms between Eben Fadlin and Herger is fantastic. You see how that grows over the movie. It's so great. And then we get the scene where Bolvi asks him if he can draw sounds, and he writes out, you know, there's only one God and Muhammad is his prophet. And I like that because it shows not only is he thinking more about this guy, but it also shows Bolvi has more to him than just, you know, the meathead warrior, which is very good little character development and very subtly done. And then the next morning where, you know, they bring back the, you know, bringing a dog to war joke, and he does like his big riding around and jumping over things. That happens. And we also get the line, the dog can jump, which is pretty great. And once again, we get a new scene where they have arrived at a port town on the Baltic Sea, making ready to sail. And they're like dragging Weath, the musician, out to the boat. And he's like passed out drunk. And they're like, oh, yeah, he spent time among the Hibernians. And, you know, it didn't do anything good for him. And so they throw him into the sea to wake him up. And then Eben Fadlin looks at the boat, looks at the sea, gets out his prayer mat and starts praying. Goes like, I'm not going to get on that thing without praying, which is pretty funny. And so we get the scene that kind of got cut up and became the intro and in the middle, where they're on the boat in the middle of the storm. And it's like, oh, this isn't the day to stay close to land. That's very similar. And I wonder why they moved that to the beginning like they did, because I guess they wanted to get like an exciting moment to hook the audience right at the beginning, which not the best. They still do that with movies to this day, where they'll show a scene from later in the movie and then go like, oh, yeah, 3 weeks ago. Like, there's a great Rick and Morty clip, which is the only Rick and Morty I've ever actually watched, where the guy's reading his screenplay. He's like, yeah, 3 weeks earlier. If you've seen that clip, you know what I'm talking about. It's brief. But yeah, it's just weird, and I don't think it works. And it's also almost like they went, yeah, we spent all this money on CGI for this ocean scene that's like a couple minutes long at most. It's like, yeah, let's get our big money shot in at the beginning. And it has aged kind of poorly. Like, the CGI, I don't remember how good it looked back then, but it doesn't look that great now. And then we get a scene that's taken from the book where they pass by, where they say, oh, there's sea monsters. And Eben Fadlin's like, oh, really? And it's a whale that comes close to the ship and thinks it's a female. And they kind of have to push it away with oars. And that scene is in the book. I remember that scene because I remember the description of the tail coming up and going, oh shit, that's a whale. So yeah, that's kind of cool that's here. I'm going to err on the side of caution and say, I don't think they shot this because it would have been expensive to do the whale tail and all that on top of all the other shit they were doing. Also, the scene in the port town, don't know if that was shot, but it should be there because it's extra character development for Weath, who was played by Tony Curran, who is an awesome actor. He was one of the best parts of Leaving Extraordinary Gentlemen as an Invisible Man. And he was the fucking Irish gangster who gets his face blown off with the shotgun in Daredevil Season 2. Yeah, he's a good actor. I like him a lot and stuff, even when it's crap. And so we get a longer scene of them approaching the coast in the fog. And they pass a ruin on the shore, which is called the Fortress of Hakon Greybeard, long since abandoned. And there's a little bit of foreshadowing here where Ibn Fadlan notices that there is no wall facing the sea. And Herger replies, well, they didn't fear the sea, and doesn't say anymore, which is kind of cool. And so then we get them moving into the shore near Hrothgar's Hall, where, you know, we have the kind of cool idea. I didn't really think of it when watching the movie, but the way it's described in the script is that the two archers, they're shooting flaming arrows to try and locate where the coast is in the fog. And it's described as like a primitive form of radar, which is fucking awesome when you think about it. And so the landing scene takes place. It's the same as the movie. You get, you know, Herger throwing the sword to Ibn Fadlan, and I can't lift this. Grow stronger, which is one of my favorite lines of the movie. It's so funny. Even if it does, you know, introduce one of the dumber things in the movie where it's like he's so weak he can't lift a sword. And like the heaviest swords, I don't think, get much heavier than 5 pounds. I'm like, it is kind of funny if they did it in that kind of context where like, oh, he's just such a fucking like sap that he can't lift a fucking 5 pound sword. But that's not where they take it in the movie, which is where it gets dumb. But so, yeah, they meet the Herald. And I've always thought the Herald was kind of strange because Edtho, like, listens to the hooves approaching, and he goes, like, ah, it's well-fed on a light mount. So he's supposed to be fat and perfumed. And like, oh, it's a silk-swaddled messenger boy when they see him. And then it's just, like, a regular-looking old guy on a horse. Like, costuming department did not get a memo. That's all I can figure. And so we get the approach to King Hrothgar's Hall, where we get them talking about there's no wall, no moat, not even a presentable fence. Couldn't keep a cow out of this place, which is one of my favorite lines in the movie as well. And there's also some extra dialogue where they refer to him as Hrothgar the Vain, so sure the whole world loves him. And we get a little more character from Herger, where he expresses doubt that anything strange is happening. He says, it's probably just bandits. We'll kill them, and then we'll go. And that's a thing that's kind of a running thing here, where Herger is more of a skeptic in the script. And there's a little bit of that in the movie. A couple of those lines are left in, but there's a little bit more, and he kind of conflicts with Skeld the Superstitious, which also develops his character a little more. And that's all kind of not in the movie. And speaking of things that are not in the movie, the warriors, they enter the hall, and there's a dispute between them over whether they should disarm, as is traditional, with Herger going, you're entering someone else's hall, it's a sign of respect to disarm. And then you have Higlak and a couple of the others are like, we don't know what's here, this is strange. And so there's kind of a factions that form, but then Bolvi, who's not really, doesn't really know what's going on, just lays his sword to the side, and that's that. This is important because you get a moment for Higlak before he dies on the first night, so you know who he is when it's like, oh, there's this one-armed guy who dies. And so they all follow suit once he does it. And they come before Hrothgar, his queen. I stopped writing her name down. It's Wello. I don't know how it's meant to be pronounced in this context. I know how it would be pronounced in the original Beowulf, where it's Weltha, Welthau, but I'm not sure how the Crichton respelling is supposed to be pronounced. And we learned that Hrothgar knew Bolvi as a boy, and so the latter asks him, what troubles you, old man? And it cuts away before the king's answer is heard to the warriors discussing the threat. And so we get the scene where Ibn Fadlan notices the bloody child running towards them. And so they then find, and so then the queen leads them to his farm, which is off in the woods. And that's a very stunningly shot scene when they're approaching through the woods, because it was filmed up in British Columbia on Vancouver Island. And they're going through like this, like the temperate rainforest that's up there, the forests are just, and it's shot with only natural light. So it's them kind of slinking through the dim light where there's just some sun coming down through the holes in the branches. Looks really great. And so they find his family's farm with the queen's help, and they find the bodies have been mutilated and partially eaten. This scene is almost exactly the same. And this confirms to them that the threat is indeed real, a race of monsters called the Wendol. And there's they discover the statuette of the mother of the Wendol, which is basically a Venus of Willendorf without the head on it. And in the movie, Rethel the archer is holding it on the end of his sword. And in the script, it's described as you would hold a turd. Stay classy, guys. And Skeld is given more moments of character here with, you know, him saying, no, don't, because he goes like, shh, when Herger says the name Wendol. He kind of like shushes him. And in the movie, it cuts there. And then, but in the script, there's a little bit more arguing where he's like, Skeld, saying names does not conjure things, and they kind of argue a little bit more, which, once again, builds character. But this whole scene plays out like the movie, including Edtha leading them out and showing them the deer fleeing to the tree line, fleeing from the tree line and saying, like, oh, we're there watching us, even now. And so they're pretending like they don't know what's going on. So they pretend like they don't know they're watching and aren't noticing what's going on and then immediately go back to the hall. The main thing that's different here is that the shot of, like, the Wendell and the shadows watching them and then drawing away, that's not here. And watching it again, I look to make sure he has the horns on the back of him. The horns that are, like, mounted on the back of his neck. You can just barely see them in the silhouette. And that's important because that means it's a reshoot, because that character of the Wendell war leader with those horns was added in reshoots because for some reason they felt that Bullvi needed, like, a specific big bad guy to have, like, a sword fight with at the end. And it's very strange because they went through all this shit shooting, like, these new scenes with this guy. And for the most part, it's well integrated. Until right at the end where the editing gets kind of choppy and then one moment I'll talk about later. And they went through all this shit to give him a fight scene that's like 10 seconds long. It's really not that great. But in theory, the idea isn't necessarily a bad one. It just wasn't executed the best way. So anything with him where it's like off to this, because he's always like watching from the shadows or he's standing off to the side. All that stuff was added in reshoots. And for the most part, you can't tell. So I gotta give Crichton credit for that. And so they sit down for dinner in the hall that night, and Hrothgar talks about how the Wendel started attacking his kingdom 2 years ago, and many of the other settlements haven't been heard from in some time. And so we get Prince Wiglaf, who is the king's son, and here it's confirmed that he's from a previous queen. He speaks critically of Bullvi and angrily walks out when the warrior frankly says, oh, you have no feats apart from killing your brothers. And there's an added bit of dialogue I like where even Fadlan goes like, is this permitted? He's like, was it permitted among your people? No, but it happens. And Hrothgar's like, well, there's your answer. I kind of like that little moment there. And it's clarified at this point in the script that the brothers, him killing his brothers, that's why Prince Wulfgar was sent south with the message and why he was told to stay there. Which was always kind of strange if you watch it, because like, oh yeah, there's another prince and we never mentioned him again. That's kind of odd. And they then hear the account of a survivor of the first attack on Estwick, who lost an eye to the Wendel, and he mentions a story his father told him, and even Fadlan speaks up as it is nearly identical to the story of Cain and Abel, and marks out the Wendel as descendants of Cain. Now, I like the idea of him finding more common ground with the Northmen, because that builds, I love that whole coming together of cultures in the story, I think that's really cool, but it's really awkward how I've never heard this in Norse mythology before, of them having like a Cain and Abel type story just with different names. Because, yes, in Beowulf, it does say that Grendel is a descendant of Cain, but that's generally considered to have been, like, an interpolation by, like, the monks who, like, preserved the story and wrote it down. So that is, yeah, I don't really, it's a cool scene, but at the same time, like, I can kind of see why they cut this. And so Edtho, who had been out scouting, and there's many more moments in the script where they send him scouting ahead, and he, like, kind of, like, it describes him as just kind of, like, disappearing into the darkness or into the distance, and he comes back later. A lot of those have just been cut from the movie, and it's a shame. But he comes back saying there will be fog that night, which traditionally signals the arrival of the Wendel, and the warriors prepare to bed down in the hall and wait, and so you get the same dialogue, you get the great one about how, like, the skein of your life was woven long ago. Hide in the hole if you like, but you won't live one moment more. And so the Wendel attack in the night, killing Ragnar and Higlak, and taking their heads. So, okay, so Holga doesn't die. In the first night, it's Ragnar and Higlak who die. And maybe Holga does die in the first. Maybe they swap some of it, because they do swap at least one character death around, which I know for sure later. But yeah, so they get killed and they take their heads as well as their own wounded and dead. But the warriors manage to fight them off, including Ibn Fadlan, who manages to wound one despite getting scratched across the face. And so his face wounds are attended to by a woman named Olga. And so they've left a club behind, which has like, it's made of wood and has like stones set into it like claws. And Ibn Fadlan mentions, I've seen these stones before. My people find them in the sea, which is an interesting detail, which isn't really elaborated on. But I wish it was in the movie, because the war club just never, you never get a good look at it, because it's only shown in like the dim light of the night scene. And so you don't get the scene later on where they're examining it more closely. You never get like a good detailed look at it. So he says, here perhaps is a claw. I'm like, is that supposed to be the arm? Like in like what happens to Grendel and Beowulf? Did they dismember a guy? Why does it look like a wooden club? It's very strange in the movie. And so they lay Ragnar and Higlak's bodies in a covered cellar. treating their deaths in battle joyously, which strikes even Fodlan as odd. And then Bolvai gives orders to get the locals turned out and start working on fortifications, which include a trench, a palisade, and a low dam on the nearby creek. Basically, it's that they can open it and then flood the moat that they're digging. So they get to work, and this is where that dumb part I was talking about comes up. So Ibn Fadlan, he gets the job of cutting the spikes that are going to go in the moat. And he then has, because he can't lift the sword, he's having trouble with it. He asks where the smithy is, goes, and he basically gets it turned into a scimitar. And then suddenly he's like a master sword fighter. He's like flipping it around, blah, blah, blah. And like in this, he even cuts a piece of meat that Weath is holding before he holds it to his face. And I'm like, yeah, there's some great lines where it's like, oh, he give him a sword, he makes a knife. And then after he does all that stuff with it, it's like, when you die, can I give that to my daughter? Which is pretty funny. But like, okay, first off, from a character perspective, he goes from being a guy who's like, I'm not a warrior, to a dude who, as soon as he has a light enough sword, he can like do all this like complicated twirling and flipping with it. I'm like, that's just dumb. And second of all, scimitars were not in common use in, you know, Baghdad yet at the time this takes place. So that's dumb. And then that's not how swords work. You can't, in the movie, they show him like grinding it down on the grindstone. That's not described here. You can't make a curved blade out of a straight sword like that. That's not how swords work. You'd fuck up the sword and it wouldn't be any use to you. But yeah, that's just dumb. That's the one thing I look at, I roll my eyes at, because I'm like, yeah, there's stuff that's like inaccurate, like the horse thing, and like the armor is ridiculous because you got Bolvai who's wearing like late medieval plate armor. You got the one dude with a gladiator helmet, which is more plausible than some of the other stuff. And then Healfdene is wearing friggin' conquistador armor. Like, that's dumb, but I can overlook it. This is just like, you make a big deal out of this. It's the character part of it that's just weird, where it's like, oh, now he's a skilled swordsman. What? But then, at least in the script, he's like, oh yeah, a real swordsman could peel an orange from horseback. And it's like, okay, you at least, you know, you justified it a little bit more. And then we get the one kind of moment where, like, he actually knows how to do something better than anybody else. And that's saying that's not in the movie, because in the movie, they just dig the ditch. It's not really brought up. Because, like, oh, yeah, I know how to dig it faster. We have all these waterways in Baghdad. Use a plow. And I'm like, you really need to explain to them they can dig a ditch faster with a plow? I'm glad that's not in the movie. It's like a played straight version of an Army of Darkness where Ash has to teach the medieval guys how to use their own spears. It works in that movie because that's a comedy. This, it's like, okay, they don't know how to use plows, apparently, in medieval Scandinavia. But okay, they cut that for the best. And so we get the scene from the movie where Olga visits Ibn Fadlan with water as he works, examines his wounds, and she mentions that the people are afraid the Wendel will unleash a dragon on them, referred to here as the Glowworm and Korgon, which is something that's not maintained for the movie. But in the book, the full name of the fireworm is the Glowworm Dragon Korgon. There's actually a title. The title of a chapter is the Glowworm Dragon Korgon, which is maybe a little few too many names. I can see why they cut them down and just said fireworm, so that's more obvious what they're talking about instead of having this jargon in here. And so she also lets slip that Ibn Fadlan to him that Prince Wiglaf is poisoning the king against Bolvai. And so then we get this leads them to trying to make an example of Wiglaf's friend Angus to, you know, show him what he's dealing with, which is this really probably one of the best scenes in the movie, like top five, is the duel between Hergur and Angus, where he picks a fight in the most hilarious way, where he just starts throwing dirt at him. And then they have like a formal duel where he pretends to be like weak and winded and then just turns on with the last second, chops his head off. Really great scene. And then the payoff for it, where it's like, oh, now he has to calculate what he can't see. Because any fool can calculate strength, but deceiving them like that, pretending to be weaker, and then striking, that means that he has to think outside the box. That's really cool. And then the little somber moment at the end where Bolvai says, it was foolish, we will miss Angus tonight, we will miss his sword. Especially since the guy didn't really fucking do anything. He just unfortunately had to be on the wrong side of this conflict. And the hilarious scene, I don't think it's in the script in the movie, where Wiglaf is walking away and he just like slices a fence with his sword in anger. It's so funny. But that's a great scene with some great dialogue. It's like, you've noticed he's bigger than you. Yes. And younger. Yes. Bet on him if you like. I may. Seriously, Antonio Banderas and Dennis Storhi have this great chemistry together. They can we get a buddy cop movie with these two guys? It would be amazing. And the fortifications are soon complete. And we get another new scene, which I don't know if this was shot, and I kind of hope it. I wouldn't want to see it in the movie because I don't feel like it fits. And he talks to Bolvai, who's carving a piece of wood, And he makes a little wooden, really good looking wooden horse out of it. And they're talking. He was like, my father, you know, I was apprenticed to the guy who did the wood carving in my father's hall when I was a boy. And even Fodlan, for some reason, is kind of a douche and is like, oh, there's more to you than a warrior, isn't there? What happened to this hall? He's like, it burned. And he says something to him like, I'm going to have to find this, because he gets really pissy with him. And I'm like, why? Like, I mean, he doesn't come off that douchey when you read it. You kind of have to read into it. So he just gets really mad at him for, like, no reason. And so that's why in the next scene, he's delivering Edtho, who's at the watchtower. He's delivering him his meal because Herger's going to do it. And even Fodlan, after that weird moment, is like, oh, yeah, I'll go take it to him. Don't worry. I have to get away. Now, it's interesting because it mentions his father's hall burning, because in the book, when they're on their boat journey, they sail past where his homeland, where Bolvi's homeland is, and his father's hall is burning, and he runs in and grabs his father's sword. So it's cool that they reference that, because that's something that's cut from the movie and it's cut from this script. But all it really serves to do is have this weird character beat where the only time in the movie they don't like each other. And it shows that, oh, he's also an artist and he has some depth to him. But we got the idea that Bolvi had hidden depths to him from the drawing sound scene, which got repeated in the beach landing. We already got that. We don't need this. It's a redundant moment. And so we get to even Fodlan delivering Edtho his meal, which is one of my favorite scenes in the movie. I actually really like this moment because Edtho is one of the few who gets like character moments in the film. And this is a really great one where, instead of being in the watchtower, he's up in a tree. He goes like, well, I expected to find you in the tower. That's why I'm not in it. I mean, that right there, cool little character moment. And so they're talking, and you know, you get the moment where he hears thunder and thinks it's going to rain. And Edtho is like, well, actually, it's these cliffs to the side here. But he doesn't call them the Thunder Cliffs in the script. And I'm wondering if they changed the dialogue in post to like make it more obvious what was happening. Because, like, oh, the surf hits the cliffs and it sounds like thunder at times. It's that they can, like, refer back to and go, oh, the Thunder Cliffs. I do wonder if that was, like, maybe a dumbing down thing they did in post. Because, I mean, all the other shit that happened on this movie, you can't discount it. But so they spot mist coming down from the hills and a line of fire following it, which is, of course, the fireworm. That is, like, an old school optical effect in the movie, and it looks really fucking cool. I always thought so. And just watching it again recently, I'm like, wow, that's, like, a really good effect. And so they head back to the hall, the fortifications, but then Ibn Fadlan leaves again to rescue a little girl and gets a glimpse of the worm, which is in fact a long line of cavalry carrying torches. In the ensuing battle, the Wendel light the village alight, which the queen and several other women struggle to put out, which you can see in the movie, but you can't, it's a dimly lit night scene using natural light, so you can't really tell it's them, and you only get like a second of it. And you get the scene where, and so Skeld dies like he does in the movie, where he tries to grab a torch off a building and he gets impaled on spears. And the Wendel, who first appear to be bear-like creatures, are soon revealed as men wearing headdresses. And they're compared to certain Native American tribes, specifically the Algonquins and the Sioux who would wear like coyote headdresses. And unfortunately, that made me laugh because that just makes me think of that scene in Shanghai Noon where Jackie Chan has the coyote thing on his head and he's smoking the peace pipe getting high. And the one Native American goes like, wow, this is some powerful shit. And so we get the cool moment where he's like, it's a man. And he just starts whacking them, cutting them. And you see, this is where the sword thing gets kind of dumb, because you could have done it in a way where he gets a little bit stronger as he's working on the fortifications. And then after that, he starts getting a little bit better till at the end of the movie, he's like a badass. And it's like a progressive thing instead of just being like, he made the sword smaller with a grindstone. Congrats. And of course, you get, you know, he starts, you know, hacking all of them up. And then Herger gets one of the best lines in the movie again, where he says, don't worry, little brother, there are more. Or it's all right, little brother, there are more. And so Weath and Halga are killed here when the Wendel burst through the gate. And it's not described how they die. And this is something I know is different, because Weath in the movie survives until the end. Like, he's one of the last guys left. So they clearly, like, decided they liked this character, or they liked Tony Curran a whole hell of a lot. So they just went, let's keep him alive longer. So yeah, Halga, the big goofy guy, he dies, unfortunately. And Rethel is wounded badly, but insists on staying to fight when Olga tries to lead him away. And that whole thing, I don't think is in the movie. I think that, like, I mean, there's all the whole thing with what happens to Rethel, just, I don't think that comes up. It really doesn't. And the battle descends into a melee with the warriors fighting them one-on-one. And there's even a moment, which is not in the movie, where Bolvi saves the queen from Wendel that has her cornered. And then the Wendel suddenly flee, and one bashing Ibn Fadlan in the chest of his club as he rides out. And in the aftermath of the battle, bodies are everywhere and the ship they arrived in has been set alight in the chaos, meaning that even if they wanted to flee, they couldn't. And also it's mentioned in another scene that there's like a, that like their fallback plan in case nothing else works is for them to start ferrying the people out of there on the boat. They don't know where to, but it's like the, it's like their last resort and they can't even do that now. Cool little moment that's been added in. And so we get the hilarious scene where he turns down the mead because he can't drink fermentation of wheat or grape. It's like, Herger just laughs his ass off and goes, it's made of honey. And so Ibn Fadlan tastes it. And then we get the whole thing where he meets with Olga and she says, we could die tomorrow. And then they have their nice little romantic moment. Now that's something they changed for the movie because in the book, they all just kind of start sleeping with, they all have, there's like slave girls who are around and he starts sleeping with the slave girls and he gets more and more sort of ingrained within the culture. And that leads to an ending I'll talk about. But it's a nice moment to add to the movie to make it a little bit more positive. And so the next morning at breakfast, where we get another great line, it's like, oh, did she finish you or bring you back to life? A gentleman does not discuss such things. And so Rethel is revealed to be mortally wounded, and they do this weird thing where they feed. I've seen this in other stuff. I don't know if this actually works, or if it's like a weird folk remedy thing, like an old wives' tale, where they feed him like a strong-smelling soup and then sniff his wound. Does that actually, if someone knows, please tell me, is that actually, I'm sure it was a real thing, but does that actually work? Because if it's a strong smelling soup and you got a bowl of it right there, you're going to be smelling it regardless. And so we know he's going to die before long. And Edtho brings in the corpse of one of the Wendel, which is unquestionably a man, which is seen in the movie. And this is where we get, you know, Ibn Fadlan mentions, you know, accounts of strange looking men in far off lands that other travelers have brought back. And Healfdene says, he saw something similar in a cage in Byzantium, and the script compares the corpse to a New Guinea native. Now, this is something that it's not addressed in the script, and I thought it would be. And obviously, they would have no way of, like, finding this out within the narrative because, you know, just the time period it takes place in. But the speculation you get in, like, the faux afterword to the book is that the Wendel are, like, a... or like one last remaining tribe of Neanderthals that have survived longer than they are thought to have. And that's a really cool idea. And it's kind of hinted at a little bit here when you get to the caves, but you would have thought that would come up like, oh, he's a caveman. But no, it's like New Guinea native, huh? But okay, it's a choice. And so Bolvi suggests they take the fight to the Wendel as they have a trail to follow. But the others aren't so sure, with Roneth saying they don't know enough and will be going in blind. So that would be a moment for Roneth to get something to say and do, which he gets a couple. And the queen gets an idea and leads them into a grotto that's down the coast where they send... We get more context for this place than we do in the movie. This is where they send the deformed, the mad, and their other outcasts to live. It has them speak to a wise old man, bad woman named Holda, who here is sitting up instead of laying down. And there's this whole thing where it's mentioned in the movie, like, oh, you're Queen Willow now, or Waylow now, or however you say your name. Yeah, you haven't come to see me at all. And we get an extension where it's like, oh, it's been so long since you've come to see me, with the implication being like, oh, you think you're above me now? And so there's an added bit where Holda, just to kind of, you know, as a fuck you, makes her go, oh, fetch me water from the stream, which the stream is, it's a sewer that runs down the middle of this grotto that they're in. And it's basically just shit. She's like, oh, the water at the edge is too warm. I want the cool water from the middle. So she makes the queen crawl out into the middle and get the water from there. I don't think that was shot just based on how the scene looks in the movie, but maybe it was. And then she gives her advice saying that, you know, slaughtering the Wendel, you know, you can do that until you die and it will make no, and you know, it'll come to no avail, but you should strike at the root, the mother, and says, seek her in the earth. And as they turn to leave, this is where a difference is. So she tells, in the movie, she tells him, oh, the leader with the horns, he too you must kill. And this was changed. This was changed from what it is here because they wanted to foreshadow the war leader at the end for the big fight. And the way they do it, instead of reshooting the scene, they just swapped out the dialogue. And I swear to God, they recycle a shot and they just, because she's holding, because Ibn Fadlan hands her the little statue of the mother of the Wendel, and she's holding it up by her mouth. And I swear to God, she's holding it up by her mouth, and they saw, ooh, that's convenient. We can dub in whatever we want. And so they dub in the lines about the war leader. And at least the shot where she says, he too, you must kill, her mouth is not moving. Once you know that's there, you cannot unsee it, and it's just ridiculous. But no, in the script, she says, great tales will be sung of the deed if he slays the mother. And he goes like, ah, but tales, songs are only sung of dead men. So she's telling him he's going to his death, which is a really interesting moment that he knows he probably won't come out of this alive, but he goes anyways. Stronger character moment than, oh yeah, there's some other asshole you have to fight. And so the reigning warriors, they ride out, and we get the great line where he says, do we have anything resembling a plan? Ride until we find them, kill them all. And it's like, oh, well, it has the virtue of simplicity, which that's in the script and not in the movie. They follow the Wendell Trail, and they find like a border marked with bear skulls on pikes. And in the movie, you don't get a good enough look at them, in my opinion. Like, they're very in the background, in the fog. And so this is what gives, you know, Ibn Fadlan the idea to look for a cave, because they dress like bears and bears live in caves and caves are in the earth. Now, this is all condensed from the book, because in the book, they follow the trail out and they find nothing. And then they go to the caves where they go to the community where there's like the dwarves are living, because they send their dwarfs out to live together. And they ask the dwarf his advice. And he says, go to the Thunder Caves. And so they go down the cliffside by the sea, and then they go into the cave from there. So they've condensed it a bit, changed it around. I think it works. And this is one of those scenes where you can actually see the boy in the background when Ibn Fadlan is talking about how, like, oh yeah, where is a cave? In the earth. And so before they approach, Bulvi sends Halthoff back to... And so they soon find the Wendell camp with the cave below. And before they approach, Bulvi sends Halthoff back to the border with the horses, telling him to wait for a while. And if they don't come back, head back to the hall. And he also sends his dog, Reke, back, who's been with him in every battle so far. And he has a harder time convincing the dog than he does convincing the kid. And they sneak through the camp, which is noted to be a nomadic temporary one. And Ibn Fadlan compares the cave to a sacred place like Mecca. So one of the things people bring up as a criticism of the movie is, oh, if they live in a cave, where are they keeping the horses? Well, one way you can look at it, and so I look at it, is that they've been raiding towns and villages for 2 years. They probably stole a lot of the horses and like added them to the cavalry as they went along. And also, with this dialogue put back in the movie, they don't live in the cave year-round. They just come back here periodically for religious purposes. And so they enter the cave, which is decorated with paintings, including one of a mastodon. Now, you do see cave paintings in the cave, and this is where in the movie, but you don't get this bit where you see like all these like extinct animals in there. And this is the thing that really hints towards them being cave people, being Neanderthals, which of course is cut from the movie for whatever reason. And so they kill the guards outside, sneak past the men guarding the inside by crawling down a sunken pathway. This is all in the movie, including Halfdane bumping into something and making noise. And in the movie, there's a really funny moment where they tell him to, like, disarm, and Wee taps his breastplate, and he goes like, ah, you'd have to kiss me first. And so they find a chamber filled with bones. This is all very close to the movie. A bloody altar, a giant version of the mother idol. And it's interesting that there's multiple Michael Crichton things that have a big pile of bones in them, because I don't recall it being in the movie, but in the book, Congo, the whole area around the Lost City is called Place of Bones in the local language, and there's a big-ass pile of bones they find in there. It's kind of funny that it happened in more than one Michael Crichton thing. And so we get the scene where they enter the mother's chamber and they sneak down the cliffs to the pool at the bottom. I do not enjoy heights, blah, blah, blah. And they stage a sneak attack on the Wendell chiefs. And so during the fight, Bulvi enters the mother's grotto where he finds her. And here she's a withered old woman lying on a pallet, and she's surprisingly fast, but he kills her quickly. This is a big thing that was reshot, because apparently it was considered wrong of the heroes to kill an old woman. And also apparently Crichton wanted her to be sexy as like a distraction, which does not come off in the movie at all. She's just a younger woman who looks weird. So yeah, and one thing I do like about that version, I don't know if it was in the original, because it's not described here, but in the reshot version, there's like strands of like kind of spider webbing coming down, like vines and stuff, and the heads of the slain warriors are hanging on the vines, which is very cool. That's something I gotta give credit for. And so in this version, Bulvi doesn't notice he's been poisoned until after he leaves the grotto, finding a silver pin stuck in his side. So it's a silver pin, not like a fang, and he doesn't notice it until later. And so they flee down a downward passage. The mortally wounded Halfdane stays behind, which is a great moment in the movie, even if the character isn't set up that great. They follow an underground river, so this is the same, and then they hear the sound of thunder, and they remember the story about the cliffs, so they dive into the river, and they emerge from the sea. And they arrive at Hrothgar's hall just as Halthoff is arriving with the horses. So the queen and the women, they see Halthoff approach and they're like, oh no, the worst has happened. But then the five remaining dudes come walking down the beach and it's awesome. I'm just imagining them coming down the beach with the freaking Chariots of Fire score playing. And so Bolvi is dying but won't live through the night. Hrothgar promises him a kingly funeral. And this is a moment, it works so well in the movie, where he's talking to Hrothgar, but he's really talking to Eben Fodlan. And he says, you know, a man could be considered wealthy if someone were to draw the story of his deeds. And Eben Fodlan says, you know, yes, a man would be wealthy indeed. It's so good. And so outside, Eben Fodlan and Hergur are talking about his impending death and how they'll have to send the dog with him, which they're not happy about. When the Wendels suddenly appear on the hills outside the hall, more than have been seen before. And I like this version because they're like blindsided by it. In the movie, they know they're coming, which is a different atmosphere. And so as the warriors and the remaining locals ready new defenses, Prince Wiglaf accuses them of causing this attack and flees down the coast on horseback like a little bitch. The Khorgan cavalry begin to approach and Eben Fodlan stops to pray, which is the same from the movie, which is a really well-written prayer before battle about the things we ought to have done but not done. It's so good. And then we get Bolvi emerges from the hall, and it's like the scene in the movie, only in this version he bursts through the door bangs open and he's there. And we get all the men together in the Viking prayer, which is a great scene in the movie, amplified by Goldsmith's music. And the Wendel charge the lines. It's not described in super big detail here. They just charge and attack and attack and attack, and then they break off like surf on a rock. And so in the movie, they added in the Wendel war leader who comes in and like fights Bolvi one-on-one. And it's not that great of a fight because he comes in on his horse. Bolvi knocks him off, hits him, stabs him, and then it's over. It's like, you really went through all that effort to add this character to the movie, and the fight scene is like 10 seconds long. Why? And like, on top of that, you have the slow motion, and when he stabs the leader, he goes like, roar, in like a really weird, like, modified audio. But okay, so the Wendel break, and their chiefs confer, and then the Wendel warriors, they give, you know, the Viking men a salute, and then they fade off into the fog and into the trees. So great. It's basically the ending of Zulu, if you've seen that movie, where the Zulu give like the sign of respect before they leave. And so Bolvi is found lying on the ground dead with many wounds, which is different from the movie. And I believe I've read that his death in the movie, where he sits on the fortifications like a throne and sticks his sword in the ground and dies that way, that was added in reshoots. That's another thing I think is stronger, is because that's like a great way to end the character, because he's a king, but he's a king without a throne. So him sitting on that and dying that way, I think is really cool. And so here we start getting scenes that are completely cut. Like the entire wrap-up of the movie is almost entirely cut. So you have subplots that go nowhere that get tied off here. And so the funeral feast follows. Eben Fodlan and Hergur, they're unwilling to sacrifice the dog. And they go, Hergur's like, well, I could go back to the old way and sacrifice a woman. And he's like, well, there's her, no, or no, or no, because he's such a big ladies' man. He doesn't want to waste any women. Which is pretty funny. And so time passes, two ships are constructed, one a funeral barge for Bolvi and the other dead members of the party, who all get burned together. Yeah, look, why would you cut the funeral scene when you foreshadowed it already? It's so dumb. And so, okay, here's coming apart. I'm going to have to find the page and read this out because I love this scene so much. This is a very important cut scene from the movie. Basically, Wiglaf shows back up and he starts starting shit at the funeral. Wiglaf put on a solemn face. He raises his mug in salute. He seems dead serious, but his retainers are restraining giggles. He says for all to hear, I was wrong about this man. This man, this Bolvi, he has done us much service. He continues in an undertone, but one meant to be heard. Not the least of which was dying as he finished it. The retainers can restrain themselves no longer. Hergur starts for him. He's elbowed aside by Eben. You have wounds. Eben pulls his sword and storms straight at him. Doesn't say a word. The retainers are too shocked to stop him. Wiglaf gets his sword out, but Eben's inside his guard in an instant. In two strokes, he's crippled and mortally wounded him, but he doesn't kill him outright. He drags him by the throat to the water, heaves him bodily onto the floor of the boat, and turns on Hergur softly with a steel we've never seen. This dog will do. Fuck yeah, why was that not in the movie? That's so awesome. No doubt they were like, that's not very heroic. And so the ship is burned by an arrow from Halthoff. And soon enough, Eben Fodlan is ready to depart, saying his goodbyes to Olga. And this is another thing. Why wasn't this in the movie? Because her character just disappears. As Olga watches, then turns to Eben, dressed now to journey. He is uncomfortable, begins hesitantly. It is unlikely I will return. She smiles at his reticence. I had not thought you would. beat, she caresses his face. You were here, and I had joy in knowing you, and I in you. Great little moment for that to end off on. Now, in the book, he just sleeps with random slave girls, and also in the book, they decide to sacrifice a woman, and he helps them strangle her to death. It's like, ooh boy, I can see why they didn't want to do that in the movie, but it would have been interesting if they did, but I do like this version too. Her girl elects to remain behind for the hunting. He says, the hunting, but turns out it's really for a woman he's taken up with. He's like, ah, you said you'd be home, blah, blah, blah. It's pretty funny. And so they say their goodbyes, which is really great. Like, I love that. It's a great, well-done scene in the movie. And then we get a longer epilogue in Baghdad, because in the movie you just see a shot of Antonio Banderas with gray in his hair sitting at a table and writing. And he gets interrupted here by a page saying generals have arrived. And he gently admonishes the boy, saying, they're generals, they'll wait. And he finishes the account, and we see him being greeted with respect by the generals, showing he has become a wiser, more respected man, and it ends. I don't know if they shot this, they might have. It's a cool little character moment, but also I'm reading it and I'm like, that is almost exactly the same as the ending to Stand By Me. Holy shit. Yeah, he gets like this when he's writing. So yeah, that is as close as we will get to the McTiernan cut of The 13th Warrior. Now, this is one I really enjoyed the movie as it is. Reading this script, you could see how it could have been even better in certain respects. And I would love to see this get put together in some way down the line if the footage still exists. But unfortunately, no one really wants to work with McTiernan anymore after, you know, the whole wiretapping thing. So who knows if someone would even want to give him the opportunity. Second of all, it's a Disney property. Disney doesn't give a shit about physical media anymore. And they're unwilling to loan their stuff out to third-party boutique dealers. So like someone like Shout Factory or Arrow. Hopefully not Vinegar Syndrome, because they'd be expensive as fuck and then like only 15 copies of it. But like something like that, like Arrow or Scream Factory or Criterion would never do it. But it would just be cool to see. Now, ideally, I would like a release of both cuts together so I can have both in HD, because I love the movie as it is. So that's ideally what I would like to see. So yeah, hashtag release the McTiernan cut. It's the thing with this script is that it's so much the same as the movie and so much different in just these really small but big ways. I'd love to see it. I'd love to see it even still, even though McTiernan did. He was on the special features for the French Blu-ray, and he said, well, I'm not pretending there's any kind of great movie in there, and so it's probably best left as a myth. I hope we can get this together and change his mind about it, because I love a commentary. Hell, I'd love to have heard what Michael Crichton actually thought about the situation years later. It's a shame he died when he did, because although his writing kind of went downhill, I read next, believe me. But it would have been interesting to hear him talk about it. And I feel like the conflict, because the conflict was, the Disney executives didn't help, but the conflict was largely between McTiernan and Crichton, and they argued over stuff. And I feel like that's kind of bound to happen when you have a producer who has also written, who has a connection to the material, and he has also directed films himself. I feel like that's bound to happen because like the way kind of you had Walter Hill kind of interfering a bit in the process, like not signing off on stuff for Alien 3, and eventually he just ended up rewriting it himself. If that feels kind of similar to me in certain respects, I mean, he didn't take over the movie from David Fincher, but you know how, you probably know what I'm getting at. But yeah, I feel like that's just kind of inevitable where you have a guy who has made movies, and he made more movies than I realized. I only thought there were like three, and then recently I looked at his IMDb, and Michael Crichton has directed like 6 or 7 movies. I didn't realize he made that many. But 13th Warrior, Eaters of the Dead, great script, great movie in spite of its flaws, and hope you enjoyed the episode, and until next time, bye.